the 1926 financial collapse in South Dakota was the beginning of the depression in that part of the America. There was really no recovery from it. Many of those banks didn't reopen until after the bank moratorium of 1933. Very well-to-do people were rubbed out economically. Many a farmer lost his land. The banks had to call in loans and mortgages, compelling farmers to sell their livestock and land, thereby depressing the market. I have some other recollections at that time, how the grain market would be manipulated. I can remember hearing farmers tell my father how the prices of grain always were down at harvest time, and always having their suspicions as to how the grain trade in the great terminal centers of Chicago and Minneapolis were manipulating the grain market. The fact is that as farmers were hauling their grain to market, and they hauled it in those days in wagons and with horses, that day after day those prices on wheat and oats and barley and rye, later on corn, would be dropping, and precipitously. There was no means of on-the-farm storage in those days, nor were there any farm loans for crops, so that a farmer could hold off the market his production until he could get a better price. It was out of these experiences of depressed prices, market manipulation, that the Roosevelt administration brought about the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the Commodity Credit Corporation, and such programs as on-the-farm storage and the Evernormal Granary, G-R-A-N-A-R-Y, Evernormal Granary Plan. In substance, every one of these programs of the 30s was born out of the cruel experience of the 1920s. Particularly as it related to the needs of farm people and rural people. One has to keep in mind that in the 1920s, America was very definitely a rural country. We had a few great cities, but a goodly share of our people still lived on the farm and in small towns. 50 years later, of course, this picture is dramatically changed. But in the 1920s, America was still an agricultural society. But it was a society that was dominated primarily by powerful financial interests who were entrenched in politics, it was a society that was dominated by powerful financial interests who also dominated the politics of the time. The railroads, the private utilities, electrical utilities, the huge banks of the East in New York, Philadelphia, and Chicago, and San Francisco. Those are the banking structures that controlled the flow of credit and dominated the operations of the Federal Reserve System. It was out of these excesses of power, the abuse of power and privilege, that the radical movements of the 20s and 30s were born. As I've said, it was out of the experiences of farmers and workers in this period of history that the political movement known as the Nonpartisan League, the Farmer Labor Party, the Progressive Party, came into being. I recall the election of 1928. My father had journeyed to Houston, Texas to attend the Democratic National Convention. I remember the day that he told me that he was going to go. He and another gentleman left Dolan driving in a Chevrolet car and drove all the way to Houston. And when Dad returned, he was filled with the drama of the convention. He told me not only had he heard Al Smith speak, but that he'd heard a man speak who he was sure would one day be president of the United States. And I asked him who that man was, and he said it was Franklin Roosevelt. As I recall, Franklin Roosevelt nominated Al Smith. My father came home an even more dedicated Democrat, and he headed up the program, the campaign in Dolan and vicinity in Spink County, South Dakota, for Al Smith. I can think of no more unpopular assignment. All of the prejudices that were ingrained in the people came to the forefront, even including the burning of crosses on the little hill out west of Dolan, South Dakota. I remember very well seeing the burning crosses out on the hill just about a half a mile west of Dolan. It was the Ku Klux Klan reminding people about the dangers of a Catholic president. But Dad was determined to carry the battle, and he had many a bitter argument in his store as customers came in and out on the public platform. By that time, my dad had been mayor of Dolan and a member of the city council. He had fought hard to maintain the locally owned municipal utility plant. He had lost in that fight to the private utility company known as the Northwestern Public Service Company at Huron, South Dakota. Dad looked upon Al Smith as a true liberal, a man of progressive thought, and believed that he would make a great president. I remember Dad having those signs of Al Smith, the placard, and a little brown derby. That was the symbol that many people, of many Democrats in those days, had to show that they were Smith supporters. I've often said there weren't a half a dozen voters for Al Smith in Dolan, and I believe that's a pretty accurate figure. Anyway, there weren't very many, and of course, Al Smith was overwhelmed, not only because he was a Democrat and that Hoover was his opponent and was a Republican, but also in a very large measure because Al Smith was a Catholic. He had everything going against him at that time, being a Democrat, a Catholic, and from New York. All of that was too much for Midwestern Republicans, who were essentially Protestant, relatively conservative, fearful of anything from New York at that time, and who looked upon Herbert Hoover with memories of his excellent work during World War I and being a reasonably moderate and liberal Republican in the cabinet of Calvin Coolidge. My wife Muriel has often spoken to me about the reaction of this election of 1928 in her family. And what happened in her family, of course, was characteristic of many families throughout America. Muriel's father, Andrew Buck, was a strong Hoover supporter. Andrew Buck was a businessman, and he looked upon Hoover as a sensible, sane, constructive, decent person. Muriel's mother, however, was a supporter of Al Smith, and as she has told me, there were many an argument in the Buck family over these two candidates for president. I always had a feeling that my mother was not for Al Smith. Mother had been brought up a Lutheran, and from, as I've said, from a rather Republican family. And I believe that Al Smith was just a little bit too much for Mother. I don't recall, however, the many family arguments, except that Mother looked upon Al Smith as being a man who wanted to repeal Prohibition. And to Mother, the repeal of Prohibition was a very dangerous thing. So I guess that Mother must have voted for Hoover. And Dad surely voted for Smith. Even though Dad was for Prohibition, he was still a Democrat. And he came away from that Houston convention convinced that Smith should be president. The years from 1929 to 1933, the four Hoover years, were memorable to me primarily because of two circumstances. First, I had graduated from high school in 1929 and was looking forward to my days at the University of Minnesota. Secondly, during those 4 years, the Great Depression put its cruel and powerful hands upon the economy of the nation and particularly the economy of the Midwest. Period. I recall during my youthful days in Dolan, South Dakota, while I attended high school from 1926 to 1929, that I used to write editorials for our high school column. We didn't have a high school newspaper, but we did have a section in our Doland weekly paper known as the Doland Times Record, period. That section was under the byline of High School Pep, HISCOPEP. During at least two of the years of my high school, I was the editor of the High School Pep column, and I used to give forth with what I thought were deep and profound reactions to the times in which we lived. Oh, as I look back over those columns, I began to see how seriously I was taking myself, as well as the times and events of that period. I wrote on such subjects as the St. Lawrence Seaway, the predicament of the farmer in the agricultural marketplace, subjects of economics, all the heavy subjects of the time. Of course, I was ill-prepared to really discuss these matters, except that they reveal what I was thinking, and I think, and also the mood of the country, period. My part of America was very concerned over agricultural prices. It was deeply troubled over the inequities of the economic system. It was worried, and justly so, over the problems of transportation, the high transportation rates, the discriminatory freight rates. In fact, many of the subjects that I was to deal with later on in Congress were coming to my attention during those very youthful years of the late 20s and 1930s. There came a time in the Congress of the United States in the 1950s when I was a co-sponsor with Senator Alexander Wiley of Wisconsin of the St. Lawrence Seaway Project. My father had been for this program or project some 30 years prior to that. Dad talked about the St. Lawrence Seaway in the 1920s. I can recall that in the 1940s, how we were so terribly worried about the impact of discriminatory freight rates on the economic development of the Midwest. This was a subject to which I gave some attention when I came to the Senate. It was in the forefront of our concerns and problems in South Dakota back in those years of the 1920s and 1930s. I recall hearing farmers and business people talk about how the railroads and the big banks had ganged up against us, and that there was really not much chance for development in our part of the country until the freight rate structure was straightened out. Then, of course, the whole subject of how agricultural prices were established was of constant concern. And later on, the Commodity Exchange Act saw to it that there could not be this wild speculation on the grain market that had taken place in the 20s and the early 30s. In other words, out of the misery and suffering of the 20s and 30s came some of the great reforms of the late 30s and the years following. I guess that most everything that really is worthwhile is born out of trouble or the experiences that people encounter. Very little comes from just theory or dogma. Most of it comes out of agony and experience. All of the banks, with few exceptions, closed their doors between 1929 and 1933. It was not unusual to see business people conducting their business through barter transactions. I can remember my father having moved our business from Dolan, South Dakota to Huron, South Dakota, having no bank with which to do business. The banks had closed their doors, so that accounts were paid through money order, U.S. Postal Service money orders, or through American Express checks, or in cash. All too often, we were compelled to accept as forms of payment for goods and commodities out of the drugstore, a hunk of beef, a number of chickens, or a few dozen eggs, or some butter, or some potatoes, or something that farmers produced. I recall that when my sister attended college at Huron College, that the tuition was paid in the forms of merchandise to certain professors. The professors were being paid by IOUs or script, which in turn could be changed at some of the stores where parents had children attending the college. It was a very primitive type of economy, but it was all that we had. I also recall in those early 30s the anger and the bitterness of the people. And one thing I remember was that it wasn't just people who had been traditionally poor that were in rebellion. To the contrary, it was people who had been landowners, who had something at one time, who were now angry and ready to march and to picket and indeed to destroy. It is generally believed that people that have been poor over a long period of time have become so accustomed to their status that they seldom rebel in order to improve their lot or to remove the inequity and injustice. It is those who once were landowners, property owners, or had good jobs and decent income who, having lost that income or job or land, became irate, bitter, angry, and radical. This surely was the case in South Dakota. I recall one day in Huron, South Dakota, seeing thousands of farmers seen hundreds of farmers march down the street and hold a mass meeting in Campbell Park, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L Park. This was the main park in the community. I also remember my father saying to me that while we as a family and with the business were exceedingly poor, our money was gone, we were deep in debt and having a very difficult time making payment on our bills, we were behind in our taxes. In other words, we were on the verge of closing our doors and bankruptcy. My dad said to me that those people who were marching in the streets and gathering in the park would still looked upon us as having something, and that if a revolution were to break out or a violent demonstration, that we would be some of the first to be attacked. In other words, our windows would be broken. Not because we had much, because we had little or nothing. Not because we had ever been well-to-do, because we never were. Not because we were conservatives, because surely that was not the case. But simply because when people lose everything, they also at times lose judgment and their sense of responsibility. I recall also how Dad used to tell me during those days when many of the unemployed were on government projects known as WPA, the Works Progress or Projects Administration, that as long as that if they weren't on WPA and receiving their checks, that we would have to close our doors. He put it this way, saying to me, son, the only reason we are not on WPA is because there are those who are, and they are getting some income, which in turn they spend in part in our store. Therefore, I want you to have respect for them. They have to go through the demeaning process of accepting government help. But just don't forget it for a moment that we in reality are also living off from government help. We get ours in the second stage. These WPA workers get their checks, come into this store to have them cashed, and we then are privileged to have an opportunity to sell them a few items off from which we can make a small profit. That way we can stay in business and stay off from WPA. But were it not for those who are receiving that income on those federal works programs, we ourselves would be on the relief line. I've always remembered that, Consul, because it gave me a sense of understanding and a sense of humility. It reminded me how interdependent our society is, and also how dependent we all are upon the lot of someone else. The 1930s in South Dakota saw unbelievable economic distress. Period. Families that had owned property and were homeowners and taxpayers were literally driven to desperation and bankruptcy. The weather conditions destroyed one crop after another. Farm prices were abysmally low. The economic system seemed to have broken down. The only protection that people seemed to have was the government. And yet these were people that had not relied on government. They were fiercely independent, but they were driven to a realization that individually they were helpless against the elements, and they felt that they were helpless against the powerful economic interests that seemed to be manipulating the economy. It was made very clear to me in my youth that interest rates, lines of credit, availability of credit, market fluctuations were all pretty much in the hands of a small group of powerful financial and economic interests. And as I've said, you add to this the hold that the railroads and the utilities seem to have on the economy, the special favoritism that seemed to be theirs, the unique role that they had in terms of the tax structure, and the ability to set rates that were discriminatory in terms of regions. All of this was bound to have its impact on the thinking of a young man, and it surely did upon me. Therefore, when Franklin Roosevelt came along with his New Deal, his administration was not looked upon as just normal politics. It was looked upon as basic change in the political and social structure of the nation. And as we look back at it, it undoubtedly was just that. Demand of the time was for action, not for philosophical dissertation. I suppose there were those, and indeed there were, that were deeply concerned about how much government interference there ought to be, or rather, how much we should rely on government as a means or force to adjust the inequities. But by and large, the overwhelming majority of the people wanted a government that cared and a government that acted in their behalf. The farmer, the worker, the homeowner, the independent businessman, the working families of the nation looked to Roosevelt and his administration as their champions, their hope, their partners, their saviors. Of course, there were the bitter opponents to all of this, those that were well entrenched economically, and those that by political philosophy and persuasion looked upon any activity of government as contrary to individual liberty and freedom. I was impressed by the fact that there was very little meaning to freedom or liberty if you were bankrupt, deep in debt, unable to face your neighbors because you had lost everything and through no fault of your own. Words like freedom and independence were very shallow and meaningless, particularly when you seemed to have lost any sense of self-respect and dignity that came through prolonged agony of depression and poverty. Therefore, there were those of us who looked upon freedom as more than the absence of restraint. We looked upon it as a positive force, where there was freedom to build and to create, and freedom to live and to live a meaningful life. We looked upon government as one of the instruments to help us make that better life, and to help us enjoy the opportunities that a open society ought to afford. All during this early period of the 30s, my part of the country suffered terrible drought and dust storms. I've said a number of times that I learned more economics from one South Dakota dust storm than I did in all my years at the university. What I learned was that no matter how brilliant you were, how schooled in double cost and double entry bookkeeping, how good a businessman you might think you were, that if the customers had no income, there was just no way that you could honestly make a profit. In other words, when the people didn't have the money, there was no way that a consumer economy, could prosper and grow. All the economic philosophy put together just didn't add up to jobs and didn't add up to income in rural America. And I was living in rural America, and I saw everything that we hope to have literally blow out of the ground, destroying not only crops and denying income, but actually destroying people. It was during that period of the early 30s and late 20s that many of the businessmen committed suicide. Bankers were jumping out of windows and committing suicide. These were good men. They were not crooks. They were desperate. And they seemed to be helpless, swept up in a tide of economic injustice and depression that destroyed them with no hope of self-defense or no hope of recovery. Those days obviously influenced my thinking in years to come. And when I became a public official, I always remembered the experiences of my father and my early experience and my experiences as a young man in South Dakota and in later on at the University of Minnesota. For example, even to this day, when I see interest rates go up and the credit tightened, I have an automatic reaction. I just feel that the plain people, the working people, the farmer, the young man or woman starting out to build a home and a family are going to be in serious trouble. All the economic theory to the contrary, I have never felt comfortable with the credit and monetary structure of this country being in the hands of a few people who decide the fate of hundreds of millions. The Federal Reserve System is today much more of a public institution than it was in those early days, if not by law, at least by practice. Nevertheless, we have still left the power over credit and interest rates and money in a large measure in the hands of a very few people. We place in them more power and more trust than we do in any elected official. And yet, to put into the hands of elected officials or politicians the interest rate structure, the monetary policy, the credit structure of this country might very well lead us into incredible economic difficulties. Therefore, we have, the temptation on the part of those who are in office to manipulate the economy for the advantage of the party that is in, the administration that is in control, could destroy any sense of stability or orderly growth. It could bring about wild inflation or devastating deflation. Therefore, in these years since the days of Roosevelt, we've been seeking to strike a balance, to establish a kind of equilibrium between the great financial structure, the great private financial structure of the nation, the quasi-private or public structure, the Federal Reserve System, and the power of the Congress and the President over fiscal and budgetary policy. I believe that we've come close to achieving a workable relationship. It would be almost impossible to describe it. It simply works because it is the product of a pragmatic approach of trial and error. To chart it, to try to describe it in layman's language, might well prove exceedingly difficult, if not impossible. The most important thing or the most important question we must ask, does it work? And to a very substantial degree, it does. In other words, today, the Federal Reserve System cannot get by with just ignoring public opinion or the legitimate needs of the economy. The private bankers today can be brought to heel by the power of the Federal Reserve System. And the Congress and the President always have it within their power to change the basic law that establishes the Federal Reserve System. Then too, because there is such an interdependency in this economy, all parts are compelled to work together, even if they might not prefer to. We are so deeply involved with each other through the system of the corporate structure, with the stock ownerships, with bonds, with preferred stock and common stock, with literally millions of stock holders, that no one segment of the economy dares play pirate or robber baron on the other. Then those persons who are elected must survive or perish on the basis of what happens in the economy. Therefore, a sense of responsibility is forced upon public office holders, just as responsibility is forced upon the managers of finance and corporate structure. This is not to deny that there are those who do take advantage of the marketplace, do take advantage of the weaknesses or strengths of government, or do take advantage of the stock market, or attempt to seek special privilege or advantage through the use of credit regulations and interest rates. It is simply to say that the days of the 20s and 30s are long gone, not to be repeated. Never again will the American people permit a handful of private entrepreneurs to ride roughshod over the populace and over the economic system. The day of the Samuel Insull and the holding company, of the banks that could loan money without any regard to reserves, of wildcat speculation on the stock market are all over. We have built into this economy, as a result of experience and oftentimes very sad and costly experience, a series of protections, of warning signals, of defenses against both deflation and inflation, against depression and recession. And we have witnessed within recent years the workings of these mechanisms that have been designed not out of theory and dogma, but have come about out of the experience, out of the experience and background of a people at work who have suffered, who have prospered, who have seen growth and stagnation. To the editor, in this section of the book, we ought to refer back to my thesis on the political philosophy of the New Deal. There's a good deal in that that we could put right into here and expand this part. I suggest that we do so rather than for me to continue to repeat it. Now, just a word about leaving my relationship with my father in his business. I had graduated from the Denver School of Pharmacy in 1933 and had taken my State Board of Pharmacy examinations at Brookings, South Dakota in the month of June 1933. I therefore became closely associated with Dad in the Humphrey Drugstore at Huron, South Dakota. That experience has been most helpful to me in my public life. I feel that I have a better understanding of some of the problems that a businessman faces. To be sure, my father was a small businessman. Our gross sales in those days were less than $100,000 a year. But I did see some of the problems that an independent businessman had to face in dealing with government. I came to appreciate the importance of what we call the profit system. After all, the only way that a businessman can stay in business is to make a profit. And the only way that the government can collect any income tax from a businessman is when he makes a profit. There are those in politics who look upon any kind of profit as sort of an immoral act, when in fact, of course, profit represents the fuel of the that represents the fuel on which the economy is propelled, or the fuel that is used for propelling the economy. It's all a question of how much and how it is obtained, whether that profit is through exploitation or whether it is through development, whether the profit is reasonable or whether it is or whether it is unreasonable. Then too, I saw the relationship of business with government when new laws were passed and regulated, and the government officers promulgated the rules and regulations under those laws. I remember so well how often the merchant, the businessman, would favor a particular law, but then with its application through the rules and regulations that were fashioned by lawyers and administrators, the same businessman would oppose the law. In my early days, I used to wonder why this was the case. In fact, I was generally critical of the businessman, feeling that he was being hypocritical. But as I witnessed government agencies through their bureaucrats and their administrators, executives, and lawyers, writing rules and regulations under these broadly designed federal statutes, I think I got a better appreciation of why a businessman was afraid of government, of too much government. Actually, it is my judgment that a number of the people that write the rules and regulations have no comprehension whatsoever of the practical problems that face many of the people out in the real world. There is a difference between the world of government and the world of commerce. There's a great deal of difference between the standards that may be set up under general statutory law and how some particular agent of government effectuates those standards. This strange situation between the law and the rules and the regulations under the law still plagues governmental action. As a United States Senator, I have made it my business to try to be an intermediary between the executive branch and my constituents. I have grown to have much less respect for some of the so-called specialists in the executive offices that seem to think they know what's best for the people, and have a kind of subtle disdain and contempt for private enterprise on the one hand and the elected representatives on the other. I don't consider this any element of conservatism. I just feel that there is a kind of professional governmental snobbishness, a kind of elitism that has grown in this country as the bureaucracy has expanded and as government programs have increased. There just simply has to be some leveling out. There must be a greater respect for the wishes, for the will of the Congress on the one hand, and those who are applying the law, administering the law, should have a much better working relationship with the economic and social community that is to be affected by the law and the rules and regulations. I guess one of my worries is that so many people come into government with no experience outside of either professional schooling or governmental activity. And that just won't work. The government must be a working partner with the economy, with all segments of the economy. A partner that has a sense of justice and balance, that is willing to use its power to prevent abuse or the excesses of power in the private sector. But if government is to do its job and to serve the public interest, then those who are in government at the administrative level must have, first of all, a respect for the people, a respect for their basic intelligence, and also a respect for and knowledge of the social economic structure that is the very base of our nation, of our country. But as I see it, and as government has grown, I find that so many people come into government directly from a university education or a professional education, such as lawyers out of a law school, or doctors out of a medical school, or engineers directly out of an engineering school, with no service in the private sector, with no way to understand the real world that is out there away from government. All too many of our people in government today have a feeling that they know what's best, and that the people will just have to listen to them, rather than they to listen. On Muriel, our early life together, and Muriel's role in my public life. I met Muriel in Huron, South Dakota. Her family was a respected family in that community, her father being one of the more successful businessmen, running a produce company. The way to describe a produce company is that it was a business dealing in poultry, in eggs, in some of the perishable commodities produced on the farms. Muriel's father, Andrew Buck, was in partnership with some of his brothers. They had a number of these produce houses in Minnesota and South Dakota, one at Huron, one at Madison, South Dakota, and some over in Minnesota. Muriel's family would be considered in South Dakota terms as a rather conservative business oriented socially acceptable family. Muriel's father was an elder deacon in the Presbyterian Church. Her mother was active in community affairs. She had two brothers. They were graduates of the Huron public school system, and Muriel had gone on to Huron College. Her brothers were aviators, and even at that early date, very experienced and able aviators. Her father was a member of the James River Valley Bank Board. He had been very generous with the college, and I would say prior to the failure of the banks and the depression, would have been considered a rather well-to-do, prosperous merchant. My father had come from Dolan, South Dakota, a little town of about 600, to Huron, South Dakota in the year of 1930, a town of about 9,000. It seemed like quite a big city to us. We were the newcomers, and the business community of Huron was tightly knit, strongly resisting any competitors or any newcomers. I recall that Muriel's people and family traded at Wheeler's drugstore. The Wheeler family was one of the most respected in families of Huron, a very early family with deep roots in the community. That even in the days that followed, after I had become engaged to Muriel, seldom did the Buck family trade in the Humphrey drugstore. The loyalties were strong and true. I first met Muriel at a college dance in Huron, South Dakota. I doubt that she recalls it, but I do. Later on, she and one of her girlfriends would come and visit the Humphrey drugstore. We had a soda fountain and luncheonette, and Muriel and a friend of hers by the name of Betty Halpenny, H-A-L-P-E-N-N-Y, would on occasion drop in for a Coke or an ice cream soda. I think she must have had some interest in me at that time, or she wouldn't have come in. I was working there, and I can recall her coming to the store. She was attractive, pretty, shapely, and needless to say, I was very much attracted to her. We started our romance in a very normal and haphazard way. There wasn't a great deal to do in a town like Huron for entertainment, except to occasionally attend a dance or some social affair at someone's home. We had a public dance hall just about a mile out of Huron. The dances would be held on Wednesday night. I, from time to time, would ask Muriel to go to the dance with me, in other words, ask her for a date. Frequently, she had another date, or she would just go to the dance with one of her girlfriends, and I would meet her there later on. My life in those days was a very busy one, simply because there was so much work to do, and we were in such difficult straits financially. I had to work in the drugstore practically every night. We opened the store at 7 a.m. in the morning, and we kept its doors open until midnight at least. And then after midnight, there was the problem was a matter of cleaning up and preparing for the next day. So many times I wouldn't get out of that store until way after midnight. But my father did arrange for me to have a night or two a week when I could have some free time. And on those occasions, I would try to have some fun and would from time to time ask Muriel Buck if she would like to go with me to a dance or to the fair or out for a sandwich or to do something like young people like to do. I never had the opportunity of really knowing Muriel's mother, because Muriel's mother passed away in the summer of 1934, and I really didn't get very serious about my relationships with Muriel until about that year and thereafter. Muriel worked for her father, and after her father sold his business, she worked as a bookkeeper for the Northwestern Public Service Company, dash the local private utility. We became more serious about our relationships, and as I said, in the year latter part of 1934 and 35. And during that time, Muriel would come to the drugstore, wait for me to complete my work, and frequently use those hours to help my father with his accounts and records. She was very good at this, and my father was very fond of Muriel, telling me many times what a fine woman she was. One thing stands out in our relationship. We were both hard workers. Muriel had her job and I had mine. We knew that if we were going to succeed at anything individually, we had to apply ourselves. Furthermore, Muriel was pretty much on her own. Her father, having sold his business, had gone to Big Stone Lake, South Dakota, and developed a small resort business in that area at Hartford Beach, Big Stone Lake. During a couple of the summers that I knew Muriel, she left her job at the public service company, the private utility, and went there to help her father. She was very close to her dad. Her father thought the world of her. In fact, I used to tease Muriel, telling her that she was her father's pet, and I believe she was. And he had every reason to be proud of her. Muriel had her own little apartment here in South Dakota, and she and her father shared a duplex for a while after her mother's death. When we'd go out to those dances, we'd have a real good time. Muriel loved to dance, and so did I. During the intermission, we'd go sit in the car and have a bottle of orange pop. There was very little hard liquor drinking, even though prohibition had been repealed. Nor did we really consume beer. We loved to visit and to talk. And when there was the intermission, why, we would sit in our car and have a bottle of orange pop and talk. We went together for about 2 years, and had become very serious in our romance. And it was in the winter. It was in December, 1935, that I gave Muriel a diamond, and we were engaged. We used to have some terrible arguments. Frankly, I was very jealous of her. She had other friends, and always has had. Furthermore, she's very independent, perfectly capable of seeming to carve out a life of her own. My work in the store often compelled me, as I've noted, to work late and to be away from her. She lived a much more organized and what you would call normal life. Her family was that way. They believed in getting up rather early, working a full day, and then the evenings were free. I was brought up in a family where the central standard was work. Everyone was required to do it. We seldom knew what a vacation was. In fact, I don't ever recall having had any vacations. Maybe a day or so off, but no prolonged period. My father was struggling to make a go of it, particularly after we moved to Huron, where the competition was much more rugged and where we were caught up in the worst of the Depression. We were new in a strange community. We were up against established business firms. We had little or no capital, and we were caught up in the worst depression in the nation's history. So it was a struggle for our family to survive. And every member of the family worked in the store. My brother Ralph, for a while, worked with the federal government as an administrative officer for the WPA. But I was there. My sister Frances, until she went off to George Washington University to live with my uncle Harry Humphrey, would work in the store. My youngest sister Fern helped out, and even my mother from time to time. However, I was the mainstay for Dad. I was in the store early, all day and late. And my father depended upon me. So my life was pretty well circumscribed by the requirements of the business. Then in 1936, my father ran for the state legislature and was elected. So for a period of time, I was literally in charge of the business while Dad was out to Pierre, P-I-E-R-R-E, Pierre, South Dakota, serving in the legislature. By the way, Dad did a marvelous job in the legislature, and he enjoyed it so very much. He was a very popular man. Dad received more votes in Beadle County, B-E-A-D-L-E, in 1936 than did Franklin Roosevelt. And remember, that was Roosevelt's banner year. To Dad, politics was a joy and an avocation. But he threw himself into the politics, into his legislative responsibilities with great vigor and effectiveness. Well, then again, during that time, I was very much tied to the store. But getting back to Muriel, I became better acquainted with her father as I used to go to visit Muriel up at Big Stone Lake. I would spend Sundays there, and sometimes was able to get an extra day. How well I remember that beautiful lake, and how much I enjoyed being there with Muriel and her father. We would go fishing. Muriel was a great out-of-doors gal. She loved to fish and to swim. I'd had very little time for that, and I gather that had it not have been for Muriel, I most likely would have never learned how to swim or really enjoyed fishing. Her father was a natural outdoorsman, a true sportsman and conservationist. He loved to hunt and to fish. He loved the outdoors, and he created a fine business there at Hartford Beach, one of the finest resorts in that part of the state. I can recall how Muriel would work to tend to those cabins. She worked alongside of her father in everything that he was doing there. In fact, one year for a couple of years, they raised many turkeys. And to raise turkeys is a full-time job. There is no more temperamental bird in the world than a turkey. And Muriel and her father were in the turkey business. And I can recall how she would write to me about the problems they would be having, how those turkeys would chew each other up, how they would panic and literally destroy each other. And of course, prices were not very good, so it really didn't turn out to be a very profitable enterprise. Dad Buck continued to expand his resort business and always seemed to have his cabins filled. They were some of the better ones along the lake. They were always clean and neat. And Muriel would see to it, and Muriel worked to keep them that way. Oftentimes I would leave here in South Dakota somewhere around 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock Saturday night and get a ride up to as far as Watertown, which was a distance of about 90 miles from Huron. And then Muriel would meet me there at 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning with the Chevrolet pickup truck that her father owned. And the two of us would drive from Watertown up to Millbank another 50 miles in that Chevrolet pickup. We loved it. We were deeply in love. And we would come and we would arrive up at Big Stone Lake at, let's say, at 2 o'clock or 2:30 in the morning, oftentimes taking a swim at that hour and having a marvelous time together. I believe that those days at Big Stone were some of the happiest days of our lives. It was in the summer of 1936 that we decided to get married. Muriel had been helping her father, and prior to that she had indicated that she might be going out to California. Well, that was just too much for me. The very thought of her going to California made me realize that unless I was going to propose to her and ask her to marry me, that I would most likely lose this wonderful girl. I hesitated about marriage because there was no money and my job didn't pay very much. In fact, I worked with my father just to get enough money to live, on which to live. Then too, I was in a very real sense sort of married to the drugstore. It took most of my time and most of my attention. And I could see that Muriel was becoming restless. So we talked about it and decided that we should get married. And we set the time for the fall of 1936. Well, something developed that I should record. It gives you some description. What I'm about to say gives you some description of the relationships that existed in my life. We had set the date for the first week of September. In fact, I believe it was for September 3rd. In fact, it was September 3rd, 1936. Muriel was at Big Stone Lake and I was at Huron and we were corresponding. Then one of the girls that worked in the drugstore decided she needed a vacation and wanted her vacation at about the same time. So she spoke to my father about it, and my father granted her the vacation. Well, that meant that there was a problem. Who was going to be there to work in the store? With one woman gone, or with one of our clerks gone, it meant that there had to be someone take up the slack. So immediately I wrote to Muriel and said that I thought we ought to postpone the wedding because one of Dad's clerks wanted a vacation. This is the only time that I recall that Grandpa Buck ever spoke sharply to me. He wrote me a letter and said in substance that if I was going to marry his daughter, I'd better make up my mind to keep my plans. That he was really surprised that I would changed the plans after we had agreed upon the date, and that his daughter had gone to such an effort to make all of the necessary arrangements. After all, Muriel didn't have a mother. Her mother had passed away a couple of years earlier. But it didn't take me long to shape up. I began to realize that I might not only have an irate prospective father-in-law, but I might even lose my prospective bride. So I told Dad that there was no changing the date, that I was going to go ahead and we were going to be married on September 3rd. Well, again, to give you some idea of the times and of my orientation to life, we set our date at September 3rd and were married in the morning of that date. Why? So that we wouldn't have to close up the drugstore in the afternoon to have the family attend the wedding. After all, the morning was the slack business hours. And the marriage ceremony took place, as I recall, at 8 a.m. That meant that the store would be closed about an hour. Following the marriage ceremony at the Huron Presbyterian Church, we had a breakfast for the guests at the wedding at the Marvin Hewitt, MARVINHUGHITT Hotel. This breakfast was given by Grandpa Buck, the father of the bride. We didn't have a photographer. Why? I guess simply because we didn't have the money. There were a few snapshots taken, but no beautiful pictures that would have meant so much to us later on in life. I almost forgot to get the marriage license. I was working in the drugstore, and it just dawned on me at the very last minute, the night before the marriage, that I needed that license. And I was able to get one of the county officials to open the courthouse and to get me the license. On the occasion of the wedding, my sister Frances had lost her garter, and we were a little late getting over to the church. I was furious with her. And as we walked into the church, and the church was filled with our friends and family, and Frances was one of the bridesmaids, I can recall saying in a voice that was all too audible, "My God, we're late." Well, at least that broke the tension, and there was a general quiet laughter throughout the church. Muriel looked perfectly beautiful in her gown. She purchased it, I believe, at Watertown, South Dakota. I don't know how much it cost, but in those days, we didn't have much money, so it couldn't have cost a great deal. I borrowed my father's car for our honeymoon. I didn't have a car of my own. It was a Model A Ford. Grandpa Buck gave us $50, and I believe I had another twenty-five or $35. And with less than $100, we started our honeymoon. My sister Frances had a job at Watertown, South Dakota. So from Huron to Watertown on our honeymoon trip, we took Frances with us. It was another way to save some money and to get her back to her work. Those were not the days of affluence and luxury. They were the days of making do and hopefully getting by. From Watertown, we drove to Minneapolis and spent a few days there, staying at the old Andrews Hotel. Now, why did I stay at the Andrews? Well, it was the hotel where my father had taken me once when he had taken me a long time before when I was privileged to journey with my dad to Minneapolis, Minnesota. We went to Minneapolis because I had attended the university there, and I wanted Muriel to meet some of my friends, and particularly to meet my old landlady, Mrs. T.A. Zimmerman, Z-I-M-M-E-R-M-E-N. She was affectionately called Ma Zimmerman. She loved me very much, and love is like a second mother. And I wanted her to meet my girl, my wife. She liked Muriel very much, and the two of them became very good friends in the years that followed. From Minneapolis, we went on to Duluth, where we journeyed by car up the North Shore along Lake Superior. We didn't have enough money to stay in the Hotel Duluth because it cost $5 a night. We were able to get a room at the Hotel Spalding, one of the old hotels, at about $2 a night. Our fun on that trip, at least the special event was to take an excursion boat into Lake Superior. A year or so later, that same boat sank. It was an old tub at the time. Well, we drove all the way back from Duluth to Huron. We had only 5 days for our entire honeymoon period. And on the way coming back, just a few miles out of Huron, driving along at about 11 o'clock at night, some cattle were in the road, and they were crossing in front of me in the pitch dark of night, and I hit one of them with the car. It broke the radiator on the car, knocked the cow off into the ditch, and there we were, marooned, stranded, some 9 or 10 miles from our home in Huron. I can recall pushing that car down to an intersection where we were able to get someone to give us a ride on into Huron, and someone to come back out and pick up the car to bring it back into town. My father's car was damaged, and I had no money to repair it. We had rented a little home in Huron, a cute little place like a dowel house. It had one bedroom and a very small living room and a little kitchen. And that's all there was to it. But it was cute, but it was attractive and neat. It had a furnace in the basement, and I remember a small lily pond or fish pond out back in which we kept some goldfish. In the meantime, prior to my wedding, I had become a scoutmaster for Boy Scout Troop Number 6 at the Methodist Church here in South Dakota. So my scouts were involved in our wedding. They gave us a clock for a wedding present, and we had that. And that clock was with us for better than 25 years. It worked beautifully, an electric kitchen clock. Muriel used to say that I had three loves, and she hoped that she was one of them, and two of them she was sure of. The Young Democrats, I was Beadle County Chairman. Troop Number 6 of the Boy Scouts, I was the Scoutmaster. And then she would say, and hopefully I'm the third. I wondered sometimes why she didn't include the drugstore, because I'm afraid I gave more to the drugstore than almost to anyone or anything. Well, that's how we got started in life. We were a couple of dreamers. We talked a great deal about my future. Muriel was always talking to me about what I should do with my life. I don't suppose there have ever been two lovers that spent more time visiting with each other about what we wanted to do. Muriel would listen to me, to my plans and my hopes. And after we were married, I recall that first winter, we wondered whether we shouldn't take what little money we could get and go on a cruise so I could learn more about the world.
or at least to have a chance to see some other parts of the world. We got magazines that showed us these ships that were cruising in the Caribbean and the Mediterranean, and we were going to save up and see if we couldn't buy a ticket and possibly get a chance to see something in Europe, or at least in the Mediterranean area. I always longed to go back to the university. My university education had been interrupted by the Depression. I had entered the University of Minnesota in the fall of 1929. I had completed the first year of my freshman year, but it was during that time that economic conditions grew progressively worse, and what allowances that I was given by my father in the early part of 1929 had to be cut off in the latter part, and they had to be cut off in 1930. After having spent 1 year at the university, it was decided that my brother Ralph, who had gone to Dakota Wesleyan for a couple of years, Dakota Wesleyan University at Mitchell, South Dakota, should go to the University of Minnesota and hopefully complete his 4-year college program. So in the winter, in the fall of 1930, Ralph went to the University of Minnesota. He got a job there, the job that I had held in the spring of 1930. I should mention that I had to get a job in the spring of 1930. The winter and spring of 1930. And I did get one working at a drugstore on the corner of 14th Avenue and 4th Street Southeast, right next to the University of Minnesota. A new drugstore opened known as the Swoboda, S-W-O-B-O-D-A, drug company. I was desperate for work. I was running out of money and I wanted to continue at the university. I'd been born above a drugstore, raised inside of one, knew a great deal about the work of merchandising and salesmanship, and had operated a luncheonette and soda fountain back in South Dakota. And I literally hounded the management of that store for a job. Frankly, I wasn't even hired at first. I just went over and started to work in the basement, sorting out merchandise, because this was a new store and all kinds of new merchandise was coming in and had to be placed on the shelf. And after several days of just volunteering my effort and speaking to the boss every day about a job, he gave me one. It wasn't much of a job. I was working behind the soda fountain from the hours of 8 to midnight, and at the noon hour from 11:30 to 1:30. That gave me 6 hours a day, and I believe my salary was 20 cents an hour. I was permitted to get food at 1/3 off, so that at least I had some cash coming in and a chance for some food. Now, to be quite frank about it, most of the food that I ate was the result of mistaken orders. Let me explain. Let's say that a customer ordered a ham and cheese sandwich, and the cook or the sandwich maker made it ham and Swiss cheese when the man wanted ham and American cheese. The customer didn't want the ham and Swiss cheese, so I'd have to take it back. And that would be what we call...
In those days, it was even difficult to find the money to buy books. And during part of my sophomore year at the university, for the quarter that I attended starting in January 1931, I checked books out of the library and used them on my library card instead of buying my textbooks. The reason, I simply didn't have the money. I was able to spend but one quarter in 1931 at the university. It was from January up through March into April. At that time, I returned to South Dakota, where my father needed me in the drugstore. We were just getting our business established in Huron, and both Ralph and I came home in April of 1931 to pitch in and help Dad with his business. Paragraph. I returned to the University of Minnesota in the fall of 1937. By that time, I'd been married 1 year, and during that year, Muriel and I had often talked about the importance of my continuing my education. In fact, she was insistent upon it and urged me to screw up the courage to leave South Dakota and to return to the University of Minnesota. I guess that I had talked to her so many times about how much I enjoyed the university and how much I missed missed being there, that she was determined to see that hope of mine fulfilled into reality, period. In the summer of 1937, I discussed with my dad the possibility of my leaving South Dakota and returning to Minneapolis, Minnesota, and attending the university. This was a very important decision for me and for my father. Dad had been elected to the state legislature and had served in the winter of 1937 as a member of the House of Representatives of the state of South Dakota at Pierre, South Dakota. He was being talked about at that time as a possible candidate for governor. I knew that he wanted very much to continue in politics, even if it was at the legislative level, as a sort of avocation. At the same time, I had become very much a part of the Humphrey Drugstore. I was able to run it. I was a registered pharmacist. While Dad had been away in the winter of 1937, I had conducted the business, taken care of all of the operation of the store. I was married. We were living in Huron, at least comfortably. I had a modest salary of about, I think it was $15 a week. Muriel was working, so that between the two jobs, we were able to make it and to pay our bills. Nevertheless, I wasn't happy in South Dakota. It was a contradiction of reactions and emotions. I loved my father very much. I enjoyed working with him. I truly found the work in the drugstore challenging and to my liking. I was a registered pharmacist and surely would have had an opportunity to take over the business which my father had developed had I stayed on. Also, my father had this opportunity to carry on in politics, and he wanted to do it very much. Knowing how much he wanted to be in politics, and knowing how much he had depended on my being with him and staying with him as a partner, and at that time I was like a partner with my dad, and he offered me a full partnership in the store, it was exceedingly difficult for me to tell him that I had made up my mind to return to the university. I recall the evening that we sat in the car out by my father's home on Colorado Avenue where mother and dad lived. I had driven Dad home that evening. In fact, it was about midnight. And I explained to him, and I said to him that I needed to talk to him about a matter that was worrying me, and I wanted to share my thoughts with him. I told him that Muriel and I had discussed my situation in South Dakota and my desire for a change. I had to tell him quite honestly that I wasn't happy, that South Dakota's weather, the economic conditions, all of that was very depressing to me. I had not been feeling well either. The dust storms, the heat, the constant depression, the feeling that you could get no place, that there was no future, all of this had been bearing down upon me. And now that I was married and was able to talk these things over with my wife, and she feeling very much the same way, we had come to the decision that there had to be a change. I explained this to my dad. I could see his reactions, both sorrow and yet of understanding. We were very close, and it was possible for me to talk to him quite frankly. I told Dad that I just wasn't happy, and he said to me, "Well, son, if you're not happy, then you ought to try to do something about it." And I shall always remember what he said. He told me in almost these identical words, "If you're not happy, make a change and try to bring happiness to yourself. The only thing you have to keep in mind is that whatever you're doing, be sure that you're not hurting someone else. If you can do something different that makes you a little happier and makes your lot a little better, and to do it without injuring someone else, then proceed to do it." I knew that my father was trying to tell me that as much as he would like to have me stay, because it surely would have made things easier for him, that he realized that I wasn't happy, that I didn't see much of a future at that time in South Dakota, and that it would be well for me to move on and to make my own life. He asked me if Muriel and I had talked about it, and I told him, of course, that we had, and that it was our mutual decision, that we both felt that we owed it to ourselves to make the break, to go back to school, where I wanted to continue my education. Paragraph. I really hadn't made up my mind what I wanted to do when I went back to school. Frankly, I just wanted to get away from the tension, the depression, the gloom, and the problems of South Dakota. I wanted to strike out on my own to have a life with my wife that was separate and distinct from that which we'd had. And in returning to the university, I really had no program worked out. I suppose on reflection, it would have been well for me to have entered the law school and become a lawyer. But what I really wanted to do was just to go back to school to study. Even then, I had some thought that I might want to enter politics someday. And I'd come to the conclusion that if a man just knew a little bit more than some of those who were presently engaged in politics, he might be able to go a long ways. I recall listening to political speakers in South Dakota, and I was at times appalled by their lack of knowledge and their lack of information. I knew that if I could get back to the university, particularly at that time, the time of the 30s, when so much was developing in our country and in government, that I could get a baseline of information and substantive material that would stand me well in case I ever wanted to enter into elective politics. So I went back to the university and just picked courses that I thought were useful and would be enjoyable. I can recall being called into the Dean of Student Affairs office and told that I simply couldn't take the number of courses that I'd signed up for. I believe I signed up for something like 21 hours, and the maximum that any student could take at that time was 15, and preferably 13. I wanted to take courses in history, in political science, in political philosophy, in diplomatic history, in literature. In other words, I had an insatiable appetite for learning and for courses of study. The dean of student affairs, I believe it was Dean Nicholson, a venerable old gentleman, told me that it was just not possible for me to take such a course, that I apparently had no counseling and advice, and that I'd have to sit down with an advisor and work out a program. Well, at that time, I'd been out of school some 5 or 6 years, and I was rather independent-minded. I came in as an out-of-state student, was paid paying my tuition, and I said to him that I was rather surprised at the attitude of the university, that when anybody came to the drugstore and wanted to buy something, we sold it to them. If they came in and said they wanted three tubes of toothpaste, even if they only needed one, and they had the money, we were willing to sell it. After all, it was their money and their decision. I said, that's the way I feel about the university. I said, I don't know whether I'm going to get a degree or not. I come down here to go to school. I'm sure that I can handle the 21 hours of course study, and I'd like to take it. I said, I paid my tuition. I'm willing to pay for whatever these courses cost.